Hello and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the March 28th to April 3rd edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration depicting a hand clutching and squeezing tightly a map of the world. The hand is wearing a ring, and the ring has on it an image of the flag of Iran. The headline, Advantage Iran. The cover leader, Advantage Iran, a month of bombing has achieved nothing. Will Donald Trump escalate or talk? That will be followed by four additional leader articles, beginning with Myth-Busting on Trust-Busting. Europe should think twice before weakening its merger rules. A strict competition policy is not the barrier to bigger firms. Then, let markets work. The case against energy bailouts. As war rages in Iran, governments must not repeat the mistakes of 2022. Then, stop the impoverishment. Mexico must unleash its private sector. Claudia Sheinbaum's biggest problem is weak investment and growth, not Donald Trump. And then finally, country first. England has shown the world how to replace farm subsidies, a rare Brexit dividend. Then we'll go to the United States section for From Little Marco to Loyal Lieutenant, Marco Rubio, the chameleon in the war room. On Venezuela, Iran, and Cuba, Donald Trump is listening to his Secretary of State. And then, finally, we'll go to the Science and Technology session for Boots on the Regolith. NASA's moon base plans mark a rethinking of its future. The changes are welcome. So, that is our lineup, and back to the top we go, as always, for the cover leader. Advantage Iran. A month of bombing has achieved nothing. Will Donald Trump escalate or talk? Even by his chaotic standards, Donald Trump has just presided over an unusually wild week in his misguided war on Iran. The president had threatened imminent punitive bombing of Iran's civilian energy infrastructure. Though Iran didn't quail, markets did. So a U-turn followed. Mr. Trump said he had become aware of secret proposals for peace talks and held off. The Pentagon then said it would send some of the 82nd Airborne Division. That suggests escalation is still a possibility. Amid such uncertainty, Iran's regime seems unfazed. Remarkably, it now has a strategic advantage over its opponents. True, the Islamic Republic has suffered dramatic blows. Many of its leaders, and hundreds of civilians, are dead. Its air defenses are in pieces. Its navy and missile launchers are largely gone. And yet, the regime endures. As we warned when this war began, its mere survival counts as a victory of sorts. At home, the regime's grip is not easing, but has, if anything, been strengthened by the onslaught from America and Israel. The hardline Revolutionary Guards are in control. Domestic opponents, whether ethnic separatists or urban protesters, are deathly quiet. Iran's stocks of highly enriched uranium, some 400 kilograms, remain untouched, probably still under rubble. Most strikingly, Iran has established a chokehold over the Strait of Hormuz, blocking exports of oil and gas from the Gulf that account for a fifth of the global supply. For decades, American military planners have prepared for this obvious risk. But the war has proved both that Iran can strangle the strait and that it would be agonizingly hard to loosen its grip. Iran's asymmetric warfare, with missiles, cheap drones, and perhaps mines against shipping, is keeping the superpower at bay. Meanwhile, even though its proxies are weaker than before, Iran still has cards to play abroad. Because the Houthis in Yemen have held off shooting missiles at tankers in the Red Sea, some Saudi oil, pumped to the coast and bypassing Hormuz, reaches world markets. A lid remains on global oil prices, though they have still hovered around $100 a barrel in recent days. But the Houthis may now be incentivized to demand a high price, such as international recognition of their control over North Yemen, to hold their fire. In Iraq, Shia groups aligned with Iran are turning against Kurds and Americans. And Hezbollah, Iran's client in Lebanon, may regain some local legitimacy as a, quote, resistance outfit, as the country comes under attack from Israel. An Israeli attempt at occupation could intensify that conflict and strengthen the group's position. In the Gulf, America's allies did not wish for war, but now fear that a wounded, defiant Iran may emerge as an even bigger threat than before. Their security systems, air defenses, and costly interceptor rockets are imperfect. Their economies look hostage to Iranian threats. One option is to go all in with America on the war. The United Arab Emirates has warned against talks with Tehran, saying that Iran is committing, quote, economic terrorism in the region. The Saudis reportedly want America to deploy ground troops. Nor is Israel really any safer than before. Benjamin Netanyahu is thrilled by the sustained attack on Iran. Yet Iranian missiles have penetrated Israeli airspace, killing civilians. The nuclear threat from Iran has not been eradicated. Without regime change, the ballistic missile threat will return, requiring Israel to strike Iran every few months. Most worrying for the Jewish state, its long-standing ties with America may be under strain. The war is already unpopular with most Americans. If casualties mount, petrol prices soar, and markets slide, who will they blame? Already some on the Republican right are pointing to Israel. Voters, especially the young, have grown more hostile towards it. Pro-Israel lobbyists in America are struggling. In short, for all the power and sophistication of the military onslaught from America and Israel, Iran feels it has the upper hand over Mr. Trump. It has shown that it is more capable than America of both inflicting pain and withstanding it. Mr. Trump launched his war, unforgivably, without offering a strategic rationale for it. Despite operational successes and his nonsensical claim of having already changed the regime in Tehran, he has yet to win any substantive gains from the fighting. As the political costs mount, Mr. Trump will come under growing pressure. His choices are to escalate or talk. He may be tempted by dramatic escalation, inflicting damage on Iran's civilian infrastructure and oil industry in the hope of compelling it to reopen the strait. Marines could grab Karg Island and its oil infrastructure, take slivers of coastal territory, or occupy islands inside the strait. That might bring limited military benefit, but none of those gambits looks like a potential knockout blow. Iran could still fire missiles and drones from inside the country, or try to mine the strait. Occupying soldiers would quickly morph into sitting ducks. Mr. Trump, having yearned to banish the memory of Jimmy Carter's military misadventure in Iran in 1980, would risk repeating it. Shifting large-scale resources to the region would leave America's military forces weaker elsewhere, notably in Asia. The less bad option, therefore, is to seek negotiations. Pakistan's government stands by to mediate. Mr. Trump says he has offered a 15-point plan to Iran, though officials in Tehran deny talks are underway. But America has previously entered into negotiations in bad faith, using them as a ruse before attacking. Iran will thus be skeptical. So Mr. Trump must agree to a full ceasefire and compel Israel to abide by it. Talks on reopening the strait and steering Iran away from its nuclear program will be bitterly difficult, and any eventual deal will be worse than what could have been struck before the war began, because Mr. Trump has unwittingly strengthened the hand of hardliners and made clear the leverage they have over the strait. The result is that for now, at least, the advantage lies with Iran. That was the cover leader, Advantage Iran. A month of bombing has achieved nothing. Will Donald Trump escalate or talk? And we'll move on now to leader article number 2. Myth-busting or on trust-busting. Europe should think twice before weakening its merger rules. A strict competition policy is not the barrier to bigger firms. An air of gloom hangs over European companies. On the global stage, many are dwarfed by America's tech titans and China's industrial giants. The European Union is home to only 3 of the world's top 50 tech firms by market capitalization. Its largest bank ranks 16th globally. To dispel the misery, some think the bloc's strict competition policy needs updating. The European Commission, which enforces antitrust rules, will soon publish draft guidelines that are expected to be more lenient. Encouraging firms to scale up is a laudable aim. Weaker competition policy would not achieve it. The debate about the purpose of European competition policy is as old as the European project itself. The principal view, which came to dominate, is that a robust competition policy serves consumers, growth, and innovation by ensuring that no firm achieves a controlling share of its market. A more political view is that it should serve wider goals, including national security and industrial policy. As policymakers seek to prepare the continent for harsher geopolitical times, it is no surprise that the political view is gaining favor. Mario Draghi, a former Italian prime minister, argued in an influential report that competition policy needs to change to support innovation and secure supply chains. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, has gone a step further, arguing for, quote, European champions and, quote, merger guidelines that reflect the realities of the global market, not just the European one. Loosening competition policy would be misguided. The hurdles in the way of bigger European businesses are not merger rules, but parochial politicians and a variety of other regulations, as the examples of banking, telecoms, and defense show. Start with banks. The absence of large pan-European lenders is not because of trust busters. Banking remains a national market. Local supervisors prevent banks from moving capital and liquidity seamlessly between a parent institution and its foreign subsidiaries. There is still no unified deposit insurance scheme. And politicians are fiercely protective of national champions, as the attempt by UniCredit, an Italian bank, to take over Commerzbank in Germany shows. The German government opposes the merger, claiming it would undermine funding for the Mittelstand. Telecoms is not a truly integrated market either. Spectrum auctions are largely national, as are rules around security, emergency services, and the like. More than 270 regulators oversee digital networks across the EU. As long as a customer in France cannot easily buy services from an Estonian provider, mergers are likely to increase market power and raise prices. Defense, the third example, is similarly fragmented, even though competition policy has already been loosened. The main reason is that governments want to keep their defense industries on a tight rein. More Pan-American procurement and a dose of competition from startups would do far more to spur both innovation and consolidation. Each example shows that the barrier to scale is not competition policy, but the fact that the single market remains incomplete. Indeed, where the market is fully integrated, European firms have managed to achieve world-beating results. Just think of ASML, which has a near monopoly on the most important chip-making machines in the world, or of firms like Spotify and SAP, which hold their own against global rivals. European pharma is a rich ecosystem made up of research institutes, smaller upstarts, and corporate giants. Integrating financial and digital services across borders is a much gnarlier task than diluting merger rules, in large part because it means encouraging national governments to loosen their grip. But if Europe really is to compete on the global stage, there is no substitute for hard graft. That was leader number two, myth-busting on trust-busting. Europe should think twice before weakening its merger rules. A strict competition policy is not the barrier to bigger firms. And moving on to leader article number three, let markets work. The case against energy bailouts. As war rages in Iran, governments must not repeat the mistakes of 2022. When crises have struck in recent years, politicians in the rich world have been quick to turn to bailouts. During the COVID-19 pandemic and the energy crisis caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, governments opened their checkbooks and made heavy-handed interventions as they sought to cushion the damage that was being inflicted on households and businesses. So it is with the energy crisis stemming from the Iran war, which has sent the price of oil and liquefied natural gas, or LNG, rocketing. Spain has slashed VAT on fuel and household electricity. Italy has cut petrol duties. South Korea has capped prices at the pump, and Japan is spending more on subsidies to limit them. Britain's government is considering subsidizing the energy bills of welfare claimants and promises to crack down on, quote, profiteering. Even in energy-secure America, Democrats have called for windfall taxes on oil companies, with the revenue channeled to households. Such interventions will do more harm than good. High prices and fat profits tell consumers to economize on energy, while encouraging producers to find and sell more. And as the energy crisis of 2022 showed, interfering with these signals can hurt some of the world's poorest people. It is arithmetically impossible for every government to shield its consumers from the energy shortage. So long as the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, the world has lost 15% of its oil supply. Add in damage to Qatar's facilities, and the global supply of LNG is down by about a fifth. No amount of subsidy can bring this back. Global energy consumption must fall. The effect of handouts is therefore to force the adjustment on others. After the continent lost most of its supply of Russian gas in 2022, many European countries spent more than 2.5% of GDP on subsidies over 2 years. The interventions were clumsy. Across the rich world as a whole, more than half the money was spent blunting the price mechanism, and about four-fifths was untargeted, benefiting richer households, which tend to consume the most energy. Europe was always going to pivot to LNG, but subsidies made the global crunch worse. As LNG imports rose by 65% in Europe, they fell by 16% in South Asia. Pakistan and Bangladesh suffered blackouts and deepening poverty. Repeating the trick would be both shameful and expensive. In 2022, Europe's interventions felt cheap because interest rates and bond yields started the year near zero. Today, the cost of debt is much higher. The war has caused bonds to sell off sharply, particularly in gas-dependent countries. Britain must now pay nearly 5% to borrow for 10 years, about half a percentage point more than during the height of the panic under Liz Truss. Borrowing more to subsidize energy will eat up scarce fiscal space, and by stimulating the economy, it could make it harder for central banks to control inflation, further unsettling bond markets. Regulatory interventions do not cost money, but are just as likely to backfire. It is desirable for providers that have not been disrupted by the conflict, including renewables providers, to enjoy high profits, because that encourages a more secure supply of energy. Quote, windfall taxes also have a nasty habit of becoming permanent. Britain never scrapped the extra levy it imposed on oil and gas profits from the North Sea in 2022, which took the marginal tax rate to a punitive 78%. It would have been better to cut the tax to promote energy security. Beyond avoiding past mistakes, what should governments do? They could temporarily increase cash payments to poor households through the welfare state, while leaving energy prices, and hence the incentive to economize, intact. In 2022, there were some more calibrated interventions. Germany offered cash support tied to energy usage. Similar principles could be applied on an international scale to direct aid to the world's neediest. During the energy shocks of the 1970s, the IMF provided extra balance of payments support for the countries most seriously affected and relieved poor countries of much of the interest bill. It may find itself having to do a modern version of that today, much as it ran a dedicated lending scheme for countries affected by high food and fertilizer prices in 2022 to 2024. The long-run challenge is clear. Economies need to be weaned off insecure sources of energy, while, ideally, burning less fossil fuel. It is a fantasy to think that this transition can be achieved if governments keep mindlessly absorbing the costs of the present system, while limiting rewards for those offering more robust alternatives. That was Leader Article Number 3, Let Markets Work, the case against energy bailouts. As war rages in Iran, governments must not repeat the mistakes of 2022. And we'll proceed now to Leader Article Number 4. Stop the impoverishment. Mexico must unleash its private sector. Claudia Sheinbaum's biggest problem is weak investment and growth, not Donald Trump. Mexico should be prospering. It benefits from tension between the United States and China. The, quote, nearshoring of supply chains on which American businesses rely means more factories are going up across North America. Mexico has become America's largest trading partner. It has been partly shielded from President Donald Trump's tariffs by the free trade zone the two countries share with Canada. Trade in high-tech products is booming. Foreign direct investment grew last year, even as it fell in other emerging markets. And yet, the economy is limping, not sprinting. After averaging annual growth of just 2% over the past two decades, GDP expanded by a paltry 0.8% in 2025, the lowest rate in years, the COVID-19 pandemic aside. Income per person has slid back to the level of 2017. Domestic investment is contracting. Pinning the blame on Mr. Trump will not work. The new tariffs that he has applied are indeed unhelpful. His constant bashing of the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, which he negotiated in his first term and which is now under formal review, is unsettling. But the American president is not the big headache. Indeed, exports grew by 7.6% last year, leading to Mexico's first trade surplus since 2020. The country's worst problems are domestic and self-inflicted. Since taking power in 2018, Morena, the ruling party, has pushed through constitutional reforms that actively undermine the economy. Judges must now be elected, adding to legal uncertainty. Independent regulators have been subverted or abolished outright. The state has entrenched its control of the energy system, locking out badly needed private capital, even as government debt soars. Rather than undertake tax reforms, the government has been shaking down large firms to raise more cash. All this comes on top of the perennial problems of crime and insecurity caused by rampant drug gangs. This is not a crisis. Mexico has sound monetary policy, with a floating exchange rate and a respected independent central bank. But the economy risks succumbing to a more chronic condition, low growth. To give her credit, President Claudia Sheinbaum, who took office in 2024, understands this. Plan Mexico, her six-year strategy, identifies low investment as the worst problem for the economy. It contains some useful ideas, such as tax breaks for research, training, and investment. But to truly rejuvenate an anemic economy, she needs to direct her energies at the underlying issues holding back her country. Most important is the size of the informal economy. Over half of Mexico's workers toil in it, a proportion that has not changed in decades. Off-the-books employers tend not to invest in their businesses, leaving them low-tech and inefficient. For investment to grow in the long run, more workers need to join the formal sector. To encourage this, Ms. Sheinbaum should scrap the two-tier Social Security system, which is based on payroll taxes and discourages formal jobs. She should replace it with a universal system funded by taxes on consumption. Coupled with less onerous regulation and a simpler tax code, this would allow the investable formal sector to expand and the economy to grow. A patchy electricity system is also curbing growth. Changes made to the Constitution by Morena have entrenched the controlling role of the state, but the state has no money to invest. Now the party is backtracking. A new model that allows private firms to take minority stakes in state-run energy projects is a welcome start. But Ms. Sheinbaum should go much further. The government should break from the party line and let private investors back their own energy projects. Morena, under its founder, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and now under his protege, Ms. Sheinbaum, has shown itself willing to rewrite Mexico's constitution to meet party goals. In doing so, it has won wide popular support, becoming perhaps the most powerful left-wing party in the democratic world. Ms. Sheinbaum still has time to use this power to help her people get richer. If she does not, Mexico is doomed to keep limping along. Squandered potential is a form of impoverishment, too. That was leader article number 4. Stop the impoverishment. Mexico must unleash its private sector. Claudia Sheinbaum's biggest problem is weak investment and growth, not Donald Trump. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, this program featuring articles from the March 28th to April 3rd edition of the magazine. Continuing now with leader article number 5, the final leader article in this issue, Country First. England has shown the world how to replace farm subsidies, a rare Brexit dividend. A common belief among farmers, though one generally uttered quietly, is that their neighbors could be doing a better job. Perhaps they have sown wheat too early or failed to tackle weeds. The same spirit of one-upsmanship might be applied to entire countries. Some have better farming policies than others, wasting less public money and boosting productivity more than pollution. Surprisingly, England has earned the right to look down on others. Brexiteers who claimed that leaving the European Union would lead to superior policies have been wrong about most things. But when it comes to farming, they were right. Under the EU's Common Agricultural Policy, Britain mostly paid farmers to farm, handing out subsidies per hectare. Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales still do a lot of that. But England, which has distinctive farming policies just as it has distinctive education policies, has remorselessly slashed such payments. They will vanish entirely next year. To get public money, English farmers must now choose to do things that provide public goods, such as establishing hedgerows or growing plants that feed insects and birds. Some activities, such as monitoring the condition of the soil, pay a few pounds per hectare. Others are worth much more. Quote, agri-environment schemes like this have existed for years in England and elsewhere. But England is unusual in redirecting almost all its farm payments towards them. In the EU, only a quarter of farm payments go to schemes of this sort. Although it is too early to tell if England's approach is boosting biodiversity or cutting greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, the early signs are encouraging. Livestock numbers are falling, tree planting is rising, and more land is being left fallow. The blow to food production is likely to be small. Farmers mostly seem to be putting their worst land into environmental schemes, the bogs, slopes, and awkward field corners where they struggle to maneuver a tractor. Fears that they would be unable to cope with the loss of subsidies have proved groundless. Only 1,200 of England's roughly 100,000 farmers took government grants to quit, and some of them were probably going anyway. Profits have held up, admittedly owing in part to Russia's invasion of a big cereal producer. Farmers have not only learned to apply for environmental grants, they are also making better use of their land and buildings. They rent fields to solar power producers and cottages to holiday makers. The removal of per-hectare subsidies has made farming harder and riskier, which may explain why the land market has cooled. Since the Brexit vote in 2016, the price of ordinary arable land in England has increased by 12%. In Scotland and Wales, which have been slower to abandon per-hectare payments, it is up by 46% and 33%, respectively. Good farmers in England should find it easier to expand as a result, or to acquire land for the first time. The scheme could be bolder. As well as paying for environmental activities, the government could try spelling out desirable outcomes, such as more birds or less flooding in a given area, and then invite farmers to bid to achieve them. The ruling Labour Party has made some peculiar decisions, such as capping the amount of environmental payments per farm. That move might seem intuitive to a party that has always disliked large landowners, but it makes no ecological sense. A flower is no less attractive to a bee if it grows on a big estate. Policies can always be improved. England's feat is to have herded farmers into a new system of environmental incentives at high speed with minimal bleating. Although angry farmers have driven their tractors to Westminster, they were protesting against changes to inheritance tax, not subsidy cuts. More drastic policies are available. New Zealand abolished agricultural subsidies in the 1980s and replaced them with nothing. It ended up with an innovative, market-oriented industry. But New Zealand needs to control agriculture too, not least because its cows belch so much climate-altering methane. With few carrots to offer, it is struggling. England's gentler approach may prove more fertile. That was leader number 5, our last leader article in this issue. Country First. England has shown the world how to replace farm subsidies, a rare Brexit dividend. And we'll turn now to the United States section for From Little Marco to Loyal Lieutenant, Marco Rubio, the chameleon in the war room. On Venezuela, Iran, and Cuba, Donald Trump is listening to his Secretary of State. A decade ago, Marco Rubio described Donald Trump as, quote, a con artist. Both men were vying for the Republican presidential nomination. Mr. Trump mocked Mr. Rubio as, quote, Little Marco. Mr. Rubio predicted that a government led by Mr. Trump would be, quote, chaos. These days, they are more polite. As Mr. Trump's Secretary of State, Mr. Rubio is studiously deferential to his boss. Mr. Trump says Mr. Rubio will, quote, go down as the greatest Secretary of State in history. Mr. Rubio has emerged as one of the president's most valued courtiers. Calm, articulate, and competent, he does his best to lend coherence to Mr. Trump's foreign policy. He is also the most prominent backer of the hawkish turn it has taken this year. In January, when Mr. Trump sent commandos to snatch Venezuela's leader, and in February, when he ordered the bombing of Iran, Mr. Rubio was at his side watching live feeds from Mar-a-Lago. The more isolationist vice president, J.D. Vance, followed events from elsewhere. If the current flurry of military adventurism ends well, Mr. Rubio will be in a strong position to run again for president. In private, Mr. Trump often asks donors and supporters who they think should be the Republican nominee in 2028, Mr. Rubio or Mr. Vance. Much will depend on Mr. Trump's endorsement, which will carry immense weight with primary voters. For Machiavellian reasons, to avoid dissipating his own power, he is likely to keep both men guessing for as long as possible. Betting markets suggest Mr. Rubio's star is rising. At the start of the year, Polymarket put Mr. Vance 44 percentage points ahead. Now the gap is only 10 points. However, an Economist YouGov poll finds that Mr. Vance still enjoys higher net favorability ratings than Mr. Rubio among Republicans, by 68 points to 47. Mr. Rubio has beaten longer odds before. When he first ran for the Senate in 2010, he started 30 points behind his opponent, a sitting governor, but ended up winning easily. His pitch to voters was partly biographical. His Cuban parents had come to America with no English and no money. They worked hard for their children, his father as a bartender, his mother as a cashier. Thus, Mr. Rubio, who at 38 was already Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, embodied the immigrant dream. Watching him on the stump, The Economist likened him to Barack Obama, another charismatic young campaigner who was, quote, good at seeming to agree with people without actually doing so. Mr. Rubio served for 14 years in the Senate, where he was well respected. His peers confirmed him as Secretary of State by a 99-0 vote, though some Democrats now express regret. He is the first person since Henry Kissinger to serve simultaneously as National Security Advisor. He also runs USAID. Rubio is a safe pair of hands, says one person close to Mr. Trump. Yet Mr. Rubio is less powerful than many of his predecessors. The institutions he runs are much reduced by Mr. Trump's cost-cutting and purges of diplomats deemed insufficiently MAGA. Some of the most sensitive matters, including negotiations with Israel, Arab states, Iran, Russia, and Ukraine, have been entrusted mostly to Mr. Trump's golf buddy, Steve Witkoff, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. A courtier does not complain about slights, nor does he expect to make policy, only to enact it. His most important task is to be by his liege, shuttling on Air Force One between Washington and Mar-a-Lago. This can be exhausting. On long trips to avoid being woken at all hours by his boss, Mr. Rubio says he sometimes shrouds himself in a blanket and pretends to be a sleeping staffer. To rise and thrive in Trump world, Mr. Rubio has had to be both ruthless and chameleon-like. As a senator, he was a leading advocate of bipartisan immigration reform, to let some illicit migrants become legal, and of arming Ukraine to defend itself against Russia. Now he serves a master with a penchant for mass deportation and a soft spot for Vladimir Putin. Some doubt his sincerity. "He's a MAGA drag queen," mocks one Republican activist. His defenders say he restrains Mr. Trump's excesses. European governments see him as one of the few administration officials they can deal with. Sometimes at odds with Mr. Vance, he has helped to avert a full breakdown in transatlantic relations and a total abandonment of Ukraine. That Mr. Trump has gone quiet about seizing Greenland is, some say, thanks to Mr. Rubio's influence. At the Munich Security Conference last year, Mr. Vance horrified European leaders with a culture warrior speech denouncing their attempts to isolate populist right parties. This year, at the same event, Mr. Rubio delivered essentially the same message, but wrapped in the language of shared sacrifice in two world wars and love for Western civilization. It got a standing ovation, and Mr. Trump's attention. The president later described Mr. Vance as, quote, a brilliant guy who, quote, gets a little bit tough on occasion and needs restraining. In contrast, Marco does it with a velvet glove, but it's a kill, right? The result is the same. Mr. Rubio has enjoyed a freer hand in the Western Hemisphere, fashioning Mr. Trump's America First instinct into a regional strategy. A fluent Spanish speaker, he cuts a vice-regal figure in Latin America. His first trip abroad as Secretary of State was to Central America and the Caribbean to help staunch the flow of migrants and set the stage for confrontation with Venezuela. Before that, however, he had to see off another courtier, Richard Grenell, who sought accommodation with Venezuela. Mr. Rubio favored coercion and regime change. Mr. Trump chose the second option, ousting Venezuela's defiant dictator, Nicolas Maduro, and promoting the rise of his deputy, Delcy Rodriguez, who he hopes will be more pliant. Next in Mr. Rubio's sights is Cuba. The communist regime there is all but broke, thanks to decades of misrule, an oil embargo, and the loss of a generous ally in Venezuela. Desperate for relief, it is talking to the Trump administration. Mr. Rubio has said the island needs not just new policies, but new leaders. Excitement among Cuban Americans is rising. Rubio is the embodiment of all the hopes and the dreams and the frustrations of the exiled Cuban American community, says Joe Garcia, a former congressman. Yet, Mr. Rubio faces a delicate task. Many of his fellow Cuban Americans want democracy in Havana and the return of property confiscated by the regime in the 1960s. Mr. Trump may opt for something easier, a Venezuelan-style deal that leaves the old detested system in place, but with better treatment for American businesses. In the Middle East, the staunchly pro-Israel Mr. Rubio was a stronger backer of war with Iran than Mr. Vance was. That puts him at the center of the action, and more exposed if things go wrong. The Iranian regime has survived 3 weeks of American and Israeli bombing and has expanded the war to the region, roiling global energy markets. Mr. Trump is unlikely to blame himself for failing to predict this. As National Security Advisor, it was Mr. Rubio's job to oversee the, quote, interagency process, i.e., the coordination between government bodies, to plan the war and prepare for its repercussions. He also made a gaffe by saying that America had to bomb Iran because Israel was about to do so, feeding accusations that America is fighting Israel's war. Success in Iran would boost Mr. Rubio. However, another debacle in the Middle East could be, quote, a career ender, says a source close to Mr. Trump. For his part, Mr. Rubio is playing down his ambitions. He says he will support Mr. Vance if the vice president runs in 2028. This may not be wholly altruistic. Mr. Trump is unpopular. Voters could pick a Democrat to succeed him. Mr. Rubio might think it shrewder to let Mr. Vance lose in 2028 and try his own luck in 2032. By that time, America's mood may have shifted again, and Mr. Rubio, a Catholic turned Mormon turned Catholic turned Baptist turned Catholic, will no doubt adapt. That was an article from the United States section, from Little Marco to Loyal Lieutenant. Marco Rubio, the chameleon in the war room. On Venezuela, Iran, and Cuba, Donald Trump is listening to his Secretary of State. And we'll move on now to the science and technology section for boots on the regolith. NASA's moon base plans mark a rethinking of its future. The changes are welcome. The United States will never again give up the moon. This line, in a memo that NASA staff received from their boss, Jared Isaacman, on March 24th, sought to recast the stakes in America's race with China to put the next humans on the moon. Since taking over NASA in December, Mr. Isaacman has added new realism to the timetable for Artemis, the late-running, over-budget, and needlessly complex moon program. Nevertheless, the chances that its current target of boots on the lunar terrain by 2028 might slip again, and that China's more streamlined program might deliver people there first, are real. Some rate them as high. This is surely one of the reasons why Mr. Isaacman's memo and the accompanying presentations made by him and senior members of his team during a day-long event at NASA's headquarters turned the agency's vague aspirations towards a permanent moon base into something far more concrete. During phase one of the new plan, the agency will send as many as 15 robotic landers to the moon as it prepares for the first crewed landing. These will, among other things, scout out sites for subsequent landings and the base to come. Phases 2 and 3 will see astronauts visit the chosen site every 6 months as they and their robot helpers build out infrastructure, including habitats that allow prolonged stays. The overall effect is to make the moon more central to NASA's objectives over the coming decade, while diminishing the importance of the first crewed landing. A brief, quote, here today, home tomorrow, visit by Chinese astronauts could be brushed off as a stunt. Though the moon took pride of place at the event, which NASA called ignition, in reference to what has to happen on the launch pad before liftoff, there were other shifts in thinking on display, most notably on nuclear power. The agency is taking its next steps seriously and facing up to some past failures. A case in point, SLS, the ill-conceived, temperamental, and outrageously expensive rocket around which Artemis has been built. It will serve for the mission that will carry astronauts past the moon next month, Artemis II, for a mission to test lunar landers in Earth orbit, Artemis III, and for the first two crewed lunar landings, Artemis IV and V. But at the same time, NASA will work with commercial providers on ways to put its astronauts into space much more cheaply and reliably. And although Mr. Isaacman said that he imagined some SLS technology might make it into those private sector bids, it would be remarkable if anything substantially SLS-like survived. Another improvement is the elimination of a space station, the Lunar Gateway, which was to be assembled in the vicinity of the moon. Gateway was originally conceived as a way station where astronauts could disembark from the spacecraft taking them from and back to Earth in order to get on to another to take them to and back from the moon. It now appears that this transfer will be done elsewhere, probably in low Earth orbit. Last year, the Trump administration cut Gateway from its NASA budget, only to see Ted Cruz, a senator from Texas, reinsert funding for it. This time, Mr. Cruz seems to be on board, so the already appropriated money he secured can be put towards the moon base instead. Mr. Cruz may be reconciled to the new plans, which will doubtless provide a lot of work for the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Joseph Aschbacher, the Director General of the European Space Agency, or ESA, who was in the audience at the NASA event, may be less pleased. Some bits of Gateway were to be contributed by other countries. ESA has been working on equipment for refueling and communications and collaborated with JAXA, the Japanese space agency, on a module for astronauts to stay in. The Canadians were to provide a robot arm, and the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center, the United Arab Emirates Space Agency, had taken on responsibility for an airlock. In all those cases, the quid pro quo was a promise by NASA to take astronauts to Gateway, a promise that now looks unlikely to be kept. NASA says, unconvincingly, that Gateway is paused indefinitely rather than canceled. It also says that it will be working with its international partners to rework their contributions into stuff the moon base will need. But this seems more a fig leaf than a practical plan, a way for all concerned not to argue in public. Behind the scenes, America's space diplomats will be facing some hard work to maintain future collaborations with international partners. One already developed bit of Gateway, though, is assured of future use. Gateway's Power and Propulsion Element, or PPE, being built by Lantaris Space Systems, an American company experienced in building large commercial satellites, is to be at the heart of a new mission to Mars. Whereas on Gateway, the PPE's state-of-the-art electronic thrusters were to have been powered by solar panels, they will now be powered by a tiny nuclear reactor. This new mission, called Space Reactor 1 Freedom, or SR-1, will be the first NASA spacecraft with a nuclear reactor on board, and the first spacecraft to use a reactor to propel itself beyond Earth orbit. The plan is to launch it when Mars and Earth are suitably aligned at the end of 2028. When it gets into orbit around Mars, it will drop three small helicopter drones into the atmosphere, where they will scout out an area that might serve as a landing site for a future crewed mission. The cute drones, on a neat mission, though, are not the underlying purpose of SR-1. It is there to herald a new commitment to nuclear power for deep space propulsion, moon base operations, and eventually human exploration of Mars. Steve Sinacor, the NASA official in charge of the program, outlined new technologies this initiative would entail, including systems for protecting electronics from the reactor's radiation and for getting rid of surplus heat, which would pave the way for future missions with bigger reactors. Mr. Isaacman stresses that these new plans can provide better value for the money NASA is getting. Progress on eliminating the SLS and Gateway looks like a good start. Encouraging competition between private companies interested in providing services is also good. Lunar landers built by SpaceX, owned by Elon Musk, and Blue Origin by Jeff Bezos, look increasingly headed for a fly-off, which will add some extra drama to the proceedings, too. There are other welcome signs of change. Mr. Sinacor prefaced his remarks with a frank account of NASA's past failures in the area. Since the mid-1960s, he said, it has spent over $20 billion on 12 different nuclear programs that have produced essentially nothing. There was a similar forthrightness about the prospects for research and manufacturing in low Earth orbit, which have routinely been hyped up in discussions of the International Space Station, or ISS. Dana Weigel, who manages NASA's ISS program, broke with this tradition by telling the audience that, quote, after more than 25 years of crewed operations, we haven't yet seen breakthrough products, capabilities, or services that generate significant demand. Contrary to the aphorism ascribed to Gene Kranz, Apollo 13's flight director, failure is very much an option. If the agency's historic character reasserts itself, everything will get delayed, costlier, and more vulnerable to a less space-friendly administration. Having scads of landers visiting the moon and nuclear spacecraft on its way to Mars before January 30, 2029, may make that at least a bit less likely. With Ignition, NASA embraced the long haul. To deliver on its promises, the agency will need to be able to sprint as well. That was an article from the Science and Technology section, Boots on the Regolith. NASA's moon base plans mark a rethinking of its future. The changes are welcome. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the March 28th to April 3rd edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veach, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I would remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ondemand.